This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, I forgot my demo again, but I will start the meeting today. Now, if you are an MH student interested in running for the MH Boyd seat, please come to the front to talk to Andy. And if you know, if we don't have anyone from MH here today, we won't add you know, the election to the agenda. Okay? And just a reminder, this is our GPSA Slack. Thank you everyone for coming here today. And as usual, we'll start with the roll call and then we'll go straight to presentation. And this is the voting members we have: Arts and Humanities, Kristen. Okay. Andy?
Here.
Rebecca?
Here.
Life Sciences, Alexa?
Here.
Kavya?
Here.
Cinema?
Here.
Physical Sciences and Engineering, Doc?
Here.
Deepri?
Here.
Jared?
Here.
Nathan?
Here.
Professional Schools, Alexei? Elizabeth? Anna? James? Nick? Social Sciences, Margaret?
Here.
Mo?
Here.
Wendy?
Here.
Cara?
Yes.
And Caitlin?
Here.
Okay. So, can I entertain a motion to move the minutes after the presentations?
We want to order the agenda and move the agenda.
Okay. Is there any any objections? Okay, seeing none, we'll have our presentation. Thank you so much, Chris, from Cornell Health. So Chris is the director of Advanced Reader Services.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And he has a presentation first. So Chris will give a short presentation, and then we'll have Q&A session afterwards. So if you have any questions, please raise your hand or your placard, and I'll keep a speaker since. Okay.
And figure out where I can stand and not have that shine on my face. Can everybody hear me in the back? Okay, great. Thank you very much. So I've got some halls and some water. I'm going to try and not cough. I apologize. I'm still fighting the endless fall cold. So my name is Chris Payne. I'm the Director of Administrative Services at Cornell Health. I'm responsible for budget and finance, insurance, health fee, all of our infrastructure and support services. So I'm here to talk to you today a little bit about what we've been experiencing in terms of utilization of services and costs, what some of our cost drivers are, and talk to you a little bit about what we're anticipating next year, at least for what we're seeing in terms of the early signs of costs and need for resources. I don't have a lot of presentations, so if you don't mind holding questions until the end, it'll be easy for me to back up to some of the slides if you need me to do that, okay? So, I want to start with a very brief overview of how we, Cornell, assure that all students have access to healthcare. And what's really important is how we assure that all students have equitable access to healthcare. Back in fall of 2015, the university implemented a health fee. That health fee covers students if they opt out of the student health plan. So all students are automatically enrolled in the student health plan. They then have to submit a waiver if they want to waive out of that student health plan and maintain their own insurance. That insurance that they're waiving with has to meet minimum requirements that the university has set. If it does meet those requirements, the student can waive, and then they're covered by the student health fee for on-campus services. There's a long backstory to that, but the reason we do that is that it's not really feasible for Cornell to participate with thousands of insurance companies. And so instead, we wrap around your insurance with a health fee to make sure that all students have equitable access to care. We also have a product called SHIP Plus. It actually has old terminology here, SHIP M. So SHIP Plus is an option for anybody who's eligible for New York State Medicaid. And many independent students are actually eligible for Medicaid. If you're eligible for Medicaid and you enroll in it, you're actually eligible for what we call SHIP Plus. So what happens is New York State pays for an enhanced version of the student health plan for you, if you qualify. Our Office of Student Health Benefits can help students navigate that, figure out whether or not they're eligible, connect them in with the state, and help them through that entire process. We have enrollment periods in the fall and the spring where people can enter into SHIP Plus. So what's really important for everybody to understand, and you can help us get the word out about this, is for most of the services at Cornell Health, it doesn't really matter whether you have the student health plan or the health fee. You have pretty equitable access. There are a few variations in there between the two coverages, but if you, and this is on our website, so you can always navigate to the Cornell Health. All right, my pointer is working. You can always navigate to the Cornell Health website, look up cost of services, and you can see this grid that shows you that for visits, there's a $10 copay whether you have the student health plan or the health fee. Student health plan is on the left and student health fee is on the far right. SHIP Plus is in the center, and SHIP Plus has essentially no out-of-pocket cost for most services at Cornell Health. So the places where, so if you need to see a counselor, a psychiatrist, a primary care provider, that's a $10 copay for the visit, for SHIP and the health fee. If you need a procedure or medical supplies, an x-ray, lab tests that we do in-house, those are all covered. You don't pay anything additional out of pocket for those services. Again, whether you have the student health plan or the health fee, it's the same coverage. Physical therapy visits, nutrition visits, those are $10 copays. Preventive care visits, visits for sexually transmitted infection screening, those are no out-of-pocket costs. Annual flu vaccination, no out-of-pocket costs. So where it starts to deviate a little bit is in immunizations. The health fee doesn't cover immunizations other than the health or other than the flu shot. Travel visits, travel medicine visits, the health fee doesn't cover those, and prescriptions, the health fee doesn't cover prescriptions. So you have to rely on your own insurance for that narrow scope of services, plus anything that we refer you out into the community for. So, as I referenced earlier, we implemented the health fee in the fall of 2015. And so you can see the point in time where the health fee was implemented on this graph. So what you're seeing on the left-hand side in the orange is university enrollment, the change in university enrollment over time. At the bottom, you're seeing us start with fiscal year 18, a little bit of gap in time, and then fiscal year 15, which was prior to the implementation of the health fee, 16, 17, 18, and some projections for 19. And so what you're seeing is in fiscal year 16, which was fall of 2015, when we implemented the health fee, there was a substantial change in visits, which are blue on the right. So we see that the utilization per population member dramatically increased after implementation of the health fee. That makes sense because the health fee actually reduced out-of-pocket costs for those students who didn't have a student health plan. In the past, they used to pay out-of-pocket for a lot of services that we delivered, like procedures and x-rays and lab tests, and they would have a surprise card at the end of their visit with, you know, a bill that could be $200 or $300. Now, since implementing the health fee, there are no more surprise cards. They have pretty reliable, predictable costs when they walk through our doors. So because we've reduced financial barriers, we're seeing an increase in utilization. We did anticipate an increase in utilization when we were doing the modeling for the health fee, but there aren't actually any studies out there in terms of what changes with student behavior when you change cost sharing. And so it was a bit of a guess to determine what exactly the change in utilization would be. We estimated a sustained increase of 10% utilization over time. We thought that there might be a big increase initially and then maybe some leveling out. In fact, what's happened is a sustained dramatic increase in utilization. So a 38% increase in primary care visits, a 26% increase in CAHPS brief assessments. That's essentially their intake process, which indicates demand or need for services, and a 68% increase in student disability services. That's what SDS stands for. So what's interesting is that the Healthy didn't do anything to change access to CAHPS. It was a $10 copay before the Healthy was implemented. It's a $10 copay after. We believe what changed is that students became more connected to us. They're coming in and seeing primary care providers more often. They're getting connected into CAHPS services more often. So they just feel more connected to Cornell Health as their primary care provider. But as you can imagine, when we were financially planning for a sustained 10% increase, and we're seeing these types of increases, we've got pressures that we're trying to respond to. We've got campus need that we're trying to respond to. And in healthcare, that means hiring more clinical staff. And so before I show you one example of hiring new staff, I am going to talk to you a little bit about cost mitigation or cost containment strategies that we're engaging in. So as we've increased staffing, we've really increased the ratio of support staff to clinical staff. So support staff are lower cost, and by increasing support staff, you can actually make your clinical staff more productive and therefore decrease the overall cost per visit. So this is possible in primary care medical services. And so we've used that strategy within medical services to contain costs. We've hired behavioral health consultants. These are mental health professionals that partner with the primary care team and actually bring mental health support to the individual real time in the context of their primary care visit. What we know is that many people who need mental health support often don't present with needing mental health support. They'll present with actually a medical condition or a less concrete concern, and we can connect them in with that mental health resource right then and there. So we've been also increasing our psychotropic medication management within primary care. We're managing stable, lower acuity cases during primary care visits in lieu of sending the individual to psychiatry. So that's a cost savings and access improvement. We've partnered our insurance staff, we call them benefit navigators, with our care managers and healthcare teams to help them offload some of the work from the healthcare teams in helping individuals navigate their benefits and figure out coverage when they need to be referred to a community provider. And we've also been restructuring my area, administrative services, in order to reduce costs and shift those resources into the clinical areas. So because of limited time, I chose to take our investment in CAHPS staffing, because I know that mental health access is an important issue that's on everybody's mind right now, as an example. But we've been investing in all of our areas. So with CAHPS, what you see here, the gray bars are our full-time equivalents. And so that's the number of staff that we have controlled for 10 and 11-month appointments. So you know, an 11-month employee is a 0.92 FTE. This, you may have heard different numbers than what you're seeing here talked about on campus. That's because oftentimes people are talking about headcount and not FTE. So this really controls for the variability in appointments per staff. So that's what the gray bar represents, and you can see along the left-hand side, that's the CAHPS budgeted professional FTE. Along the right-hand side, which is the green line, you see our CAHPS visits. And so you can see what's happening here, and it, I'm sure, mirrors what your experience is. There's a growing demand, there's a growing need for mental health support. And we're trying to predict it and get ahead of it. And in fact, that's what you can see on the fiscal year 19, which is the far gray bar, that you're seeing that we've actually invested in about 4.5 more FTE, 5 more people, in trying to get ahead of the demand. We do not yet have all of those staff in place, which is why students are still experiencing wait times this fall. We also had some unanticipated absences. So what we're anticipating being fully staffed in the spring, and that will be a good measure of how the increased resources translate to improved wait times and better access. We're also bringing in per diems to help with some of the work that they can do, things like brief assessments when you call up and just have to have a one-time engagement with a provider or groups. So we have ongoing cost drivers. These are inflationary factors that influence our budgets every year. Most of our budget is salary. It's been true of most healthcare organizations. So our salaries, university-wide, are increasing at a rate of 2.5 to 3% per year. And so that's a significant cost driver for us that we have to address. I should clarify that this is not 2.5 to 3% increase in our overall budget. It's 2.5 to 3% increase of the salary and benefit portion of our budget, just to clarify. Healthcare salary markets are increasing at a faster rate than the university salary improvement plan is increasing, so we have to plan for an additional 1% increase on top of the 2.5 to 3% to remain competitive and be able to attract and retain clinical staff. Our services and supplies are inflating at about 2% per year. The population, the enrollment of this institution, since we implemented the health fee in fiscal year 15, has grown by 1.3% per year, and we all know we're talking about continued increases in the size of the population. With every person coming onto this campus, there's predictable need and demand for health services. There's predictable utilization for health services. We are experiencing a significant increase in the need for utilization of mental health services. That's really not unique to Cornell. It's something that's happening nation and worldwide, and it's uncertain where that trajectory is going right now. We're also, as you saw earlier, have seen a substantial growth, even bigger in primary care than in mental health. Early signs indicate that this may be stabilizing, but we all know in this room that one data point does not make a trend. So we still don't know whether we've seen some leveling out of the per population need for primary care services or not. So our finances, we've got some major changes going on. One of them is in order to respond and effectively meet all of this need on campus, we've had to use one-time funds. So those are reserves and gift, one-time gifts. And those total in the fiscal year 19 budget, current year, $800,000. Those over the next 2 years will be depleted. And so we need to cover that gap. On the expense side, we've got lots of ups and downs, but overall, we're seeing before all of those inflationary factors. So the other change, we've got other changes, and those are netting $100,000 decrease, so a little bit of an offset from the decrease in revenue that we are anticipating. So the net impact is a $700,000 operating deficit that we're going to need to close, in addition to the annual inflationary factors that we talked about earlier. In addition to that focus, I want to lift a little bit and talk about some of the strategies that we've collectively been talking about at Cornell Health, that we've been talking about institution-wide, and that the Student Health Benefits Advisory Committee has been talking about. So, and I use the stream metaphor. You can use a lot of different metaphors. But essentially, most healthcare organizations, and Cornell Health, while it's somewhat of an exception to this rule, is not a total exception to this rule, spend a lot of money downstream on urgent intervention. We nationally spend a lot of money on hospitalizations and emergency room visits and medication errors and what have you. So we are spending a lot of our resources downstream on urgent intervention. That's not really what moves the needle for the health of the population. What really moves the needle is going as far upstream as you can get and reducing the need for health services from the beginning by influencing the environment in ways that you can. So I tried to give examples in our setting. If you go way upstream, improving the environment, improving the academic environment to reduce the inputs for stress and anxiety, going down midstream, improving access by providing rapid access to mental health support and providing transportation to and from visits. These are strategies that actually many involved public health entities have moved toward. Investing upstream, which is cheaper, to avoid the downstream urgent intervention, like mental health hospitalizations and ER visits caused by a person not being able to get to see their healthcare provider and delaying care until it gets urgent or emergent. So we are trying to focus upstream. Student Health Benefits Advisory Committee is entertaining some ideas about upstream investment. And so closing the gap. In order to close the funding gap and meet the cost pressures that we're experiencing, we would have to increase the health fee in fiscal year 20, next fall, by 10% or $38. So that would increase the health fee from its current $370 per year to $408 per year. That does include the CAHPS staffing increase that's currently being funded with short-term funding, as well as some other expenses that are being covered with short-term funding. It'll also factor in to the student health plan premium increase. So the health fee and the student health plan, there's a component of the student health plan that moves right along with the health fee. It's called a capitation. It gets paid to Cornell Health. It's about 20% of the overall premium. It gets paid to Cornell Health to cover services that the students who are enrolled in the student health plan use. So the health fee and the capitation move together and increase together. However, just the rate development for the student health plan is still underway, and that there are other factors that may cause increases or decreases in the premium. And also, we're talking about expanding services, and as I said, the Student Health Benefits Advisory Committee, SHBAC, is considering recommendations for a multi-year increase investment in upstream measures to improve student health. So I'm going to stop there and open it up to questions.
I have Matt next.
So, first of all, thank you so much. We've spoken many times before. I really appreciate the very important and great work that Cornell Health does. This is my sixth year at Cornell. I was an undergrad here and I've gone straight through. So actually, I was here and still involved in shared governance back when the health was first contemplated in the fall of 2014. And then later announced in the spring of 2015, and then went into fiscal year 16, as you mentioned. And I would just say the way it was sold to people in shared governance and then rolled out to the campus at the time is respectfully very different than what I'm hearing now. And I find that concerning. In that, I mean, the reference is if he came in at $350, we said our where you say it's going, an increase of $58 in 4 years. And when the fee was first brought in members of shared governance on the student and graduate graduate assembly, I was an undergrad. We were, in essence, asked about messaging, and we were actually showing up the confidential side, the breakdown of the fee and where it's going, and ensure this is a conservative estimate. We shouldn't have to constantly keep tinkering with it. The reason we're breaking it out is because we can sit over there. It's not tied to the fickleness of the central administration. We have our budget, and with the way it was broken out, because of things that are going to be amortized down, the fee shouldn't have to go up by leaps and bounds every single year. And unfortunately, it seems that whether that be bad projections or otherwise, that's no longer the case. But it's something I'm just concerned that it was sold to the community, and people were very upset. I mean, frankly, people try to show up for a season meeting, which doesn't happen every day, thankfully. So that's a very concerning thing. That's hard one area, and we're moving to another. And I also just want to note, in your list of inflationary pressures, you mentioned the population of Cornell is increasing. If you mind explaining how that affects your cost, because conceivably, every single student is either paying the fee or they're paying your stock ship
rate.
Yes. Yep. So, and because of that, in essence, it would appear to me that increases in enrollment are not directly going to put a pressure on your costs, because if every single student comes the additional revenue of someone else paying a fee in one form or another.
Okay. So I will answer the last clear question first, and if I miss other questions, please repeat them. But the question at the end was, how is student enrollment increasing at 1.5 or 1.3% per year? How is that influencing our costs when we're getting more money in for every student who is enrolled, because we have both a student health plan and a health fee? There are a couple of things that are important to think about in that context. One is that the student health plan, capitation, and the health fee are not our only source of funding, but they are the only source of funding that grows with the population. So they make those funding sources make up about 40% of our revenue. We do have more static university allocation, which comes from the tuition that you pay. So it all comes from students, but that is not tied to enrollment. That's a more static, inflationary growing item. So that's one reason why it's a little complicated in terms of the impact of the growing enrollment. The second is what I said to you earlier when I was showing you the growth in utilization of services, is that we're not sure yet where it's ending. We still are not certain that we understand the cost per member of the population, because we're seeing the cost grow as we increase resources and students use more resources. So we've got to get to something that looks more like a steady state before we can feel confident that based on student enrollment, we can predict cost and we can set the LFB without variation in rates from year to year. So it's certainly an imperfect science always to predict human behavior. It's especially difficult when there isn't a lot of data out there about the subset of the humans that you're serving. So there is not a lot of data out there about the behavior of students and health-seeking behavior and insurance and co-pays and cost sharing. I hope that helps.
It does.
I can
quick follow. We talk after reviews, but we talk after reviews. Right? My quick question would be, if we don't have a lot of data, right, where do you see it tapering off? I mean, is it going to be we are actually doing something on this line until it does taper off? Or, I mean, the original proposal when this was brought forward, I thought was out of time. Clearly, there were errors in the calculations. At what point do you think we'll be able to say, instead of just we don't know where it's going, it's growing and outpacing our wildest projections, at which point do A, we catch up? Or do the projections adjust to say that we're going to have projections that are overly aggressive so that we're better off not having to say only a 10% increase or a copay increase, et cetera?
So the question was, at what point do we anticipate demand tapering off or utilization or need tapering off? And I will be transparent and honest with you, it's difficult to answer that question. We don't have a lot of data to draw from. What we have seen, again, with primary care, is an early indication, a data point from last year, of a leveling off. But that behavior may change over time. I want to point out, though, that we don't want to assume that we as a community are going to be static in this process. In fact, as you heard me say earlier, we're looking for ways to not just be passively responding to the need that's presenting at Cornell Health's doors, but in fact proactively get out there and start to influence the factors that are driving that need and help to reduce the need. That's actually what evolved communities do and think about when they're thinking about how to manage a health system. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out and speaking. It was a very informative presentation. What I wanted to focus on was the deficit number that you indicated, the operational deficit of 700,000. It wasn't clear to me if the student health fee increase that you proposed from 370 to 408, if that would cover that operational deficit. What would be the difference there? And then, or not, which I'm expecting, how will that be covered going forward? Am I expecting more one-time gifts?
Sure. Thank you for the question. The question was, it wasn't clear whether the increase in the health fee would close the gap when I was presenting the revenue and expense numbers. In part, it's difficult in a 20-minute presentation to present a lot of data. So, but to answer your question, the health fee increases at 10%. The health fee is set at, if the health fee increases 10%, the health fee is currently set at $370. The student health plan actually provides more per capita funding because students on the student health plan use more services. So the equivalent student health plan amount is about $450 because they use services at a higher rate. So that 10% increase will actually yield more from the student health plan than it will from students who are paying the health fee because of those differential utilization rates. That will help you actually make the math work. Thank you.
Okay, I have Elizabeth.
Thank you for the presentation.
Yeah.
So I have a few questions. The first is about the graph that you showed with the top clinical indicators, with the overlying graph. was that data specifically for monitoring what population this demonstrated that all students include staff?
Sorry, yes, thank you. I didn't really spend enough time with you. So this isn't all students. It's just student data, undergraduate and professional.
So if you have that data specifically for graduate professionals?
Not with me, no, but we definitely do have utilization data broken out by the different student groups.
And would you say college is kind of like the undergraduate?
I cannot say that with exact confidence. I would say like it looks similar, but I can't say with confidence that it's, that looks exactly like this. No.
And my second question is, so the projected medical costs for the country in 2019 is only 6%, but I was wondering if you could clarify why there would be a 10% increase, if that's due to university-specific inflation or what's rationale for that?
So the question was, why might the percent increase for us here on Cornell's campus be different than what we're experiencing nationally? And the reason is because we are essentially backstopping the current services that we're providing by using other one-time funds, and we have to make up that gap as well as address the inflationary factors. When you're looking at what's happening nationally, it's essentially just addressing the inflationary factors, not addressing one-time funds backstopping the costs. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Next slide, Becca, please.
So as someone who literally studies data and the certainty with which we speak about it, I'm not really at all surprised that student behavior hasn't been static, and that this change wasn't captured by the model in 2015. So building off of what Matt was contributing, I am really concerned that we're only 4 years out and we're already seeing such significant unanticipated changes that weren't. It's not that there's a change, but it's a change that wasn't proposed as a possibility when this was rolled out. So what did your office learn in 2015 during this change and during the subsequent controversy? I was also here at the time. And how do you plan to change the way, I mean, you being here obviously is one, but how do you plan to change the way that this proposed change will be messaged and rolled out so that we keep the people who are actually providing this service or working for this service should actually trust you?
Okay. So the question, that's okay, I'll take it personally, I appreciate the question. So the question was pointing back to the fact that we didn't predict this level of an increase back in 2005, what did we learn and how are we going to change the way that we're engaging with the community so that people can understand the benefits and trust us?
Yeah, I don't think it's us understanding the benefits.
Okay.
I think it's trusting.
Okay. So in terms of history, I think one piece of important history is that when the health fee was proposed and modeled, we weren't anticipating what was projected was a 3% increase per year in the health fee. What actually happened was after the initial implementation, the health fee was held flat.
Where was that anticipation coming from? Who was at that table?
It was modeled and it was by mostly senior administrators and professionals. And some of the modeling was fairly late in the game, shared with a student group, but there was no clear charge for that student group. It was a complicated situation for sure for students to weigh in on. So when the modeling was done for the healthy and the amount was proposed, it was also proposed that the healthy would grow at 3% per year, essentially matching inflationary rates around health services and salaries and benefits. What actually happened was it was implemented at $350. It was then held flat on the first year. It increased at 2.3% the second year and 3.3% the third year. So in part, what we're doing is catching up now from times where it was held artificially low, because these cost pressures were occurring, and this is part of the reason that we're covering the cost right now with one-time funds. So in terms of what we are doing differently, you're correct, maybe in here, engaging with the Student Health Benefits Advisory Committee openly and transparently on all of our budget planning so that they spent about 6 to 7 hours with us. really going through a lot of detailed data and financial projections for 10 years. So we're doing that as transparently as possible. We're also planning to, what we are doing right now is reaching out to students much more proactively. Many students, if not all students in this room, hopefully got an invitation to meet with their primary care provider or assigned a primary care provider. We do send welcome messages to the student health plan enrollees. We're planning this fall to send out a similar welcome message describing benefits and services and inviting people to come in and use them for people who are enrolled in the health aid. Those are some of the changes that we're making.
I have Kavya.
Thank you for the presentation. I have two questions that I guess slightly out of the scope of the presentation, and if that's true, let me know. The first was, why international students are not allowed to opt out of student health plan and pay the health fee, and I'm wondering why that is.
Okay, so the question was what is the policy rationale for not allowing international students to waive out of the student health plan? So international, that is a policy decision that was made because of the typical challenge with navigating insurance in the U.S. that's brought from outside of the United States. It is students often face barriers and high out-of-pocket costs when they attempt to use insurance that isn't operated from within the United States. So that's the policy reason that you're asking. That's a risk management university policy. That's how I can explain that, the rationale to you. I will say, though, that international students can appeal that decision. So there is a formal process by which you can say, I think my insurance works well, I think you should allow me to use it, and you can make that appeal, and they review the appeal.
My second question, though, also that appeal process is not made very clear, but when hiring, you say you're hiring new CAP staff, especially that's one of the things you focused on, I guess I was wondering, and this is something that Strategia has heard of CAP quite a bit, in that their staff is extremely limited in diversity. I've heard from international students, from domestic students of color, that they've often had very bad experiences at CAP because of this, and how it's pronounced health planning.
So the question was, how are we attempting to address diversity in our CAP staff? That has been a common concern raised that our CAP staff is not diverse enough. We have actually had a large focus over several years as we're bringing new staff in to focus on diversity. We've gotten approval to go above our budgeted FTE as we search for diverse candidates. And we have worked hard to also communicate with the student population to let you see our staff, to see the diversity that we already do have. While you are correct, the diversity of our CAP staff does not reflect the diversity of this community, the percentage of our staff that are diverse are much higher than the percentage of staff that are diverse. Counselors that are diverse in the markets. So we are effectively bringing in a high share of diverse counselors, but it's a challenge to bring them in, and it's a challenge to keep them in a rural isolated community like Vivica. So those are some of our uphill battles that we're continuing to work on. Thank you.
Do you have time for two more questions?
I do, yes. Thank you.
So, Cinnamon?
Hi. I was wondering, I was looking at your screen notes for, and specifically the upstream changes, so that sounds really great to be able to change our environment to reduce stress and anxiety. But it seems like that's an issue that a lot of people are working on, and it's a really complicated issue. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about what you envision Cornell Health's role in that.
Sure. Thank you for the question. So the question was, what do we envision Cornell Health's role could be in the context of reducing stress and anxiety in that upstream model? Thank you for the question. Actually, what we are proposing that we do is partner public health professionals with faculty to help them together develop data-informed methodologies to actually get what we know about stress in any environment where you're learning or trying to improve achievement is that you actually need stress in order to improve, right? But that stress has to be balanced. So if you go too far, stress too much, you can actually create an environment where you're causing harm, but if you find the balance between stress and learning and a protective environment, you can actually improve outcomes, reduce overall anxiety, reduce need for mental health services. So it's that public health faculty partnership that we're proposing. Yes?
Yes.
Sorry, I also have a question about the upstream funding. Mental health exercise is one of the best ways to reduce stress and improve health mentally and physically. So I was wondering if you could talk about why the university eliminated the reimbursement for the Cornell gym membership plan.
So the question is why observation was that exercise helps people stress and with health, just maintaining their health. So why did the student health plans benefit for reimbursement for Cornell Fitness Centers? Why was that taken away? And it's because we actually follow. We are a self-insured plan, and we follow New York State's model language. So we follow it. When that benefit came out as a required benefit, it was added. When New York State removed it, we removed it. So we follow those New York State guidelines exactly.
Okay. So one last question from you.
Sorry, just a quick question about SHP Plus and how this interacts with student helping. Are students able to waive the student health fee if they aren't able to afford it, and like, how does that interact with financial aid and student benefits?
Okay, so the question was, how does the health fee interact with SHP Plus with financial aid benefits, and can individuals waive the student health fee? So the answer to the question about waiving the student health fee is no. No Ithaca campus student can waive the student health fee. It's a mandatory fee for anybody who waives the student insurance. How it interacts with financial aid: if a student is eligible for grant aid, then they receive additional grant aid to cover the student health fee. And essentially, the student health fee is considered part of their cost of attendance and factored in when the grant amount is being calculated. How the health fee interacts with student or with SHP Plus, it doesn't, because a student who's enrolled in SHP Plus does not pay the health fee. So you're either enrolled in a SHP product or you pay the health fee, not both.
Okay. I think I've exhausted this questionnaire list. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I or others are happy to come and continue dialogues with you about Cornell programs and services, funding and finances. We're happy to have these conversations.
Some updates from our Cornell Cinema Liaison.
What are you called for today? That'll be 10 minutes,
half minutes. After the presentation, right? Yeah. So, because Krista is also here.
In the meantime, hi everyone, I'm Krista. I'm the GTSA liaison starting a few weeks ago to Cornell Cinema, and also on the Appropriations Committee, and was involved in the process of creating the recommendations last year, which I will talk about in a moment.
Can everyone hear her? No, not really.
So? Okay, I will talk a little louder.
Okay.
Have you had a chance to read the letter that was attached to this?
It's in your packet. At the last page, there is a letter of support from Cornell Cinema.
Well, I can also read it out if that's necessary.
Yeah.
Alright. So just to give you a little context and a little reminder, and if you were not here last year, then an introduction. So last year when we were making decisions about the student activity fee allocations, in the case of Cornell Cinema, we had sort of a special case where we came up with a three-part recommendation. And the three parts were that the committee recommended that in addition to one, funding Cornell Cinema to the full amount requested, that number two, CCN, the GPSA, would develop an agreed upon system to ensure a sustainable decrease in SAF funding starting with the next funding cycle. So that's, we know how that happened. But also that we would provide Cornell Cinema with our assembly's endorsement and assistance of CC's diversification of funding strategy. In other words, one of the things that came out in the process is that Cornell Cinema would be seeking out co-sponsorships all across Cornell, and that we would be supporting them with letters of support primarily. And the first such case is now, as they are seeking out support from student and campus life. Okay. So, the letter, which should be in your packet, in the tool. So this is the letter that we wrote. I've spotted a few typos, which I will correct. But this is the letter itself. It says, the GPSA is writing this letter to express our support for Cornell Cinema's continued success on the Cornell campus. And as a key to that success, the cinema's securing of new sources of funding. In the past year, Cornell Cinema has experienced a significant cut to its budget via losing its funding from the undergraduate student activity fee. While the GPSA decided on supporting the cinema to the fullest requested amount of student activity fee funding, in light of the cinema's increasing financial difficulties, we also decided, together with the cinema, on a phased reduction plan for upcoming cycles, meaning that the cinema will have to both make significant changes in its functioning and find new funding sources, to continue its presence on campus. While the GPSA has decided on reducing our contribution to the operations of Cornell Cinema, this decision was by no means a reflection of how we value their existence on campus. In fact, we agreed to continue lending our support to the cinema in its efforts to find new funding sources at Cornell, including through providing letters such as this one. It is important to us that the cinema keep its double purpose in its film and program selection, bringing both educational and popular entertainment films for students. Many faculty and teaching assistants frequently assign class assignments or extra credit options related to the cinema's offerings, proving that students, as well as various programs of the university, are benefiting academically from programming offered at the cinema. On the other hand, many students utilize the cinema as a form of alcohol-free entertainment on campus, and we believe that this makes the cinema an important entity of student and campus life's holistic approach to mental health on campus. We are delighted to hear, and I can talk a little bit more about this if anyone has questions. We are delighted to hear that Cornell Cinema has plans to reduce their ticket costs and minimize barriers to access by instituting a low-cost, all-access annual pass for students. We are confident that this is one example of the cinema's continued creative strategies to balance financial discipline with a wide variety of programming, and we are hopeful that a partnership with students and campus life would allow for even more new ideas like this to emerge. In our interactions with Cornell Cinema, the leadership has been exceptionally responsive to our requests.
Therefore, we have confidence that they will continue to adapt and work well together with other campus partners to deliver the best experience for undergraduate, professional, and graduate students. We applaud the Division of Student and Campus Life for working with the cinema to find ways to sustain this invaluable resource for students at Cornell, and hope that you can give them the support that they need to flourish and keep their long-established legacy on this campus.
Do you have more to say on
this? I can answer questions if you have.
So first I will be taking in questions. If you have any questions in regards to Cornell Cinema or the letter, you can raise your hand or flag it. Matt?
This is a lot of people in the Assembly Library have called Cinema because they weren't here last year, they have to be aware of it. I know a lot of people probably only in undergrad at, say, movie, Cinema for an activity, but we might provide some context to the Assembly around the plan for, around the Cinema's plan for an all access app and how that would help them and shift their model to be more sustainable.
Yes. The pass, the idea behind the pass is that, well, there are many. So I should start by saying that the cinema's currently, the funding for this year has been provided by the university. The bigger question is what happens starting next year. So the cut that they experienced has been made up for by the university for this year. So their plans for what is going to happen financially next year is currently being mapped out, and they will have a detailed plan for what they're going to do by the end of the semester. But we know some parts of the plan and what they're working on. And so the main point here is a new low-cost, all-access annual pass where the current plan is to introduce it at an especially low rate at around $16 to $20 for undergrad. So this would provide access for them for the entire year. And then perhaps as low as $5 for grad students, because keep in mind that we're contributing to them significantly more than the undergrads. So the idea, one of the main ideas is this would reduce their costs reduce the costs in student staff because the box office is one of their main costs in keeping that working. And, yes, so it's a little complicated, and there are other aspects of it, but the main idea is that if it's as low as $5, in the case of grad students, for example, this would mean that as soon as you buy your first ticket, you're actually buying a pass for the whole year. And so from then on, you would not be needing to buy tickets anymore. So that's the idea. I'm sorry if I'm not clear enough.
There's just the financial model of the cinema. Like, for example, like, I'm the commissioner from Roundabout. The way that fund will be used is to use people's functions. Like, where that fund will be used.
Can you clarify the question?
Like, you're thinking of the function, right?
Yes.
I'm just trying to think of where would you use that money, like, for?
What is the budget for?
Yes.
So the majority of their costs will go to either staffing or the rental costs, right? So the film exhibition costs. In line with that, their main reductions to their budgets that they're thinking about currently is reducing both staffing, especially student staffing, but also the hours of their professional staff. Right? So they have both professional staff and student staff. So they're reducing the screenings, the number of screenings they will have to. And that means a cut both in terms of the rental fees and in terms of the staffing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Andy?
Just a really quick question. I noticed when I went to Cornell Cinema that before the movie there was like advertisements available. Is the new financial model, is it thinking about changing the prices for how much you charge to advertise within Cornell Cinema? Is that, do you know if that's part of it?
I'm not sure, but I will ask.
Okay. If not, maybe a suggestion.
Thank you. And let me just add just one more thing. So one of the questions is why student and campus life? And I just wanted to add this thing because it's one more piece of information, is that SEL has historically worked together with the cinema, even though they have never co-sponsored it. Currently the cinema, this is one of the questions that comes up often, currently the cinema is renting both the theater and their office spaces from SEL. So one of the things that they're wondering about is whether that rental fee can be waived as part of the co-sponsorship.
So, I'm assuming by instituting something like all your paths, the number of students buying that should increase. Hopefully, I buy more if it's cheap, like one year paths. Do you have any idea in modeling like how many more people will be coming in?
They're hoping for as many as possible because, once again, their main thing is if let's say, like in an ideal world, everyone would just opt to buy the annual pass, that means that they practically don't have to keep up the office box, the box office site. So,
right.
So for them, that's actually a big gain in terms of staffing and how that works out and how much work they have with that. Because that's one of the main areas where they have difficulties.
Correct. Well, they're not really looking at that as a revenue source, but as a reduction in staffing costs.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So with this letter, what we were hoping to do is to ask the assembly to actually formally approve the letter, and that I, as the president of the assembly, should then send this to the new student and campus life. So specifically, BP Lombardi and Dean Pentecor, that they are actually meeting tomorrow. So this is time sensitive, I know we have in our bylaws it says that we cannot formally vote on things that is introduced right away, but this is time sensitive, if we don't have it today, this is probably moot, or we would need another form of letter that is different than this, right? That's that. Yeah.
Sorry, just a question about the formalities of passing a letter. How does this differ from a resolution? What exactly?
So I don't think the bylaw is very clear on it. Yes, Alex?
Yes.
Do
so,
you want to say something?
So one can make the argument that any formal motion is essentially a resolution, whether it's typed up or not.
Yeah.
Right. So by the conservative estimate, you would have to treat this as a resolution, just saying we are signing on to the letter, essentially.
Okay.
Also, I would like to answer that is that rather than have to submit to the president, this does not need to go to the president.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. And if everyone decides to do this, vote on this, we could do that by supermajority vote. So we override the bylaw and do that. That is an option. And before we go further along, Andy and I are actually were involved in writing this, so I would like to pass on the chairmanship of further discussion of this matter to Alex, to be fair on all of this.
All right, I'll take the gamble that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Okay, so essentially what I'm looking for is to entertain a motion to consider the GBSA signing onto this letter. And then if we did that, then I would also need an additional motion saying that we waive the requirement to wait to a meeting before we consider it for a vote. Yeah?
Motion to have the GBSA sign off.
You're going to have to speak louder, I'm sorry.
Motion to have
Motion to have the GPSA sign on to this letter.
All right. So, no, to consider. To start talking about it, yes.
Cool.
Second. Okay. So the motion of the table is to have the GPSA debate whether to sign on to the letter. And there was a second. Yeah?
Oh, no, I thought we were voting.
Oh, okay. Is there any dissent in voting on whether to debate on it? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor? No. Right now, we're just pushing a voter to debate on it.
Great. Right. For point of information, the distinct vote to approve the override provision in the bylaws, but talk about this in the agreement of voter on today?
No, that's a second one. Okay. It's a different one. This is just whether we want to debate it at all, right? Because right now it's not a thing on the floor yet, right? So all those in favor of considering signing onto this letter?
Just talking about it.
Yeah, just talking about it. Raise your hand. Okay. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Can we have your placards or hands raised high?
Oh, 15, 16. Okay, is he 17? Yep, okay. All those opposed? Alright, so 17-0-4, therefore we will at least bring this onto the floor. Now we have to need a motion, or I will entertain a motion, of whether to waive the requirement to wait a meeting before actually discussing and voting on it.
Motion to waive the requirement to wait one meeting to vote.
Seconded.
Alright, so, all right, is there any dissent to voting on whether to waive the requirement? Seeing none? Alright, so all those in favor of waiving the requirement to wait a meeting, please raise your finger. Alright, 17. Yep. All those opposed to waiving the requirement? Okay. Seeing none, the motion passes with a supermajority, and it is now open for discussion. The floor is open for debate on this letter, which means you can move to vote on it, or you can move to amend it, and anything is open. Yes?
So, thank you for bringing the letter. I hear on the provisions committee on the last week to discuss all this. I think this letter is that it's not touching the civics, it's touching rather the idea that the assembly values at Cinemont think that there's room to system and secure alternatives to funding. The one thing I would recommend we add to an action motion after this is we also talked about this and helping them realize off-taking last year and then noticing that and their model. The reason we said a step down is because their model is sustainable, it can't stand the fee. And to do that, we said we're going to help them secure alternative funding, as well as also helping them realize cost savings. And I think it's important to note that in the letter, and we're not just looking, in essence, to take the money we're giving them and get it somewhere else. We're also trying to help them streamline the organization. And I think that's what they were interested in last year. So I would motion to amend on the last line of the current paragraph, where it further reads, this is the sentence starting with, in fact, we agree to continue lending our support to the cinema in its efforts to find new funding sources at Cornell, as well as realizing costs and rules to realize cost savings.
Yes.
As well as realize cost savings. And then leave the rest of that.
Alright, so the motion on the floor is to insert the language as well as realize cost savings onto the line as written. Is there a second to that motion? It is a second. Alright, so now we're debating whether to add this line to the letter.
Motion to call the question.
Alright, so there's been a motion to call the question on adding this line.
Second.
Second. All those. Is there any dissent to voting on this amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adding this line, please raise your placard. All those opposed? Okay. 15-06. So this amendment passes, this is now part of the letter, and we return to the original motion for this entire letter.
I have a question.
Dietrich is next, and then copy.
So just to clarify, when was this letter written in by whom?
So, I would refer to someone who actually...
So, all, like, the content was, like, all Krista, but I helped her in putting it into words.
But this was all by the AC, or was this by the AC, or was this by just a group of committee members to the, like,
this,
the liaison that went out to them?
This was by me as a liaison.
Okay.
So Mary... the director of Cornell Cinema brought it to my attention that she's going to have this meeting with SCL and that she would appreciate a letter of support from GPSA if that's possible and if we all approve of it about 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. And I then contacted Rina and we drafted this letter.
I see. Thank you. Sorry.
As a clarification, you also contacted the AC chair, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It was like right after last meeting or something like that. So I told her this. You have to do it at this meeting.
Javier is next.
Oh, I just had a question on how much did we fund them for last year?
What was it?
11.
Yes.
$11.
It's
per student.
It was
per student. Okay.
Yes. So it's an $11. So it was specified as 11 in this cycle, with a reduction plan that goes 9, 7, and $5. So down by $2 with each 2 year cycle.
The speaker's list is currently empty.
Motion to call the question on this letter and it's for the
Okay, there's a second. There's a motion to call the question on approving the letter. You dissent. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
I'm withdrawing.
Okay. Yes.
Sorry.
The floor is yours.
I'm just a little bit surprised, I suppose. I mean, I was just a little bit. Because I never. So I knew that the GPSA supported the Cornell Cinema previously, but I'm a little bit confused exactly why we feel that the GPSA writing this additional support in the form of a letter to VP Bombardi in response to a meeting that we didn't hear about before 2 weeks ago is something... I'm really confused by the timeline and why exactly this letter needs to be passed in support with the GPSA. Since we already have provided support in the past, we have a clear financial plan. What exactly, like, is this providing or does this change?
So, I think that just as a general strategy that we are in support, was that started last year, right? So that's why I started with what our recommendation was, and that was approved last year, right? The specific case of who Cornell Cinema would be contacting to get support is up to what is happening, right? So because the time of the meeting was settled about a month ago, there wouldn't have been...
Just to add to it, like, I feel like this letter is kind of consolidating everything, like, from our activity, what happened there. Like, it's kind of to clarify, like, the fact that, yes, we might be going down in numbers, but someone might look at that and be like, oh, you're not supporting the Cornell Cinema. It's not that. And so we just want, I feel like, to be extra... to clarify what the purpose is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's also, I would add on to that it's also the opposite, right? That on paper it might look like, oh, they fully fund it, right? But it's not just that we fully funded them to the requested amount, but it's also that we said we do that on the condition that this would be reduced
with each cycle, right? So I think it's also a clarifying statement of exactly what we promised to do in this case. And the GPSA is not the only one who's providing, who Mary has reached out to for supporting letters. She has also reached out to the undergrads, and I think that they've drafted a similar letter as well. I'm not sure.
Okay.
All right,
next on the speaker's list is
Matt. Go ahead and add to that. I mean, last year there was a very spirited discussion on appropriate element of the assembly about the cinema. I mean, the undergrads took the decision and they ended up passing, they cut funding off at the end of last year. I think there was a discussion in the agreement that the cinema was not, as perhaps couldn't stand the fee in its current form, which is why we agreed to step it down over the extent of a decade, given the high final alternative funds. So I think a letter like this, and it's also why I wanted to add the cost savings, and that we said we help you find additional revenue, find ways to save money, and we're doing so since we're slowly stepping down off the fee because we didn't think it's a good fit for the fee, but it sounds like not because we don't think it's a good fit for Cornell. And I think that's really what the intent was last year. It's why we set all our set up the plan and why we put it into our government documents. And in this letter, I mean, if this letter helps the university see value in that and clarify our position that we didn't fund it in the full amount because we think that they can stand the fee, which we didn't do. But we're also not getting rid of them because we think they're lack of value. Rather, we think they're valuable, not because of the fee, but that the money should come from somewhere and that we're happy to help them get more money as well as help them save money in terms of the costs.
Alright, the speaker's list is currently empty again.
I would like to call a question on this letter.
Alright, so there's been a motion to call a question on approving the letter.
Second.
And it's been seconded. Is there any dissent to calling the question to vote on whether to approve the letter? Seeing none, all those in favor of GPSA approving this letter, please raise your placard now. All those opposed? Abstain? Right. So, vote of... Wait, you abstain? Okay, so 16-05, the motion passes. We have approved the letter. Congrats, I suppose.
Thank you.
Turn the power to Rhea.
One more reminder, is there any Masters of Engineering student present here who's here for to run for the voting? Okay. So we have one. Is there another person?
We'll see the minutes first.
So since we're done with our presentations, we'll go to the minutes first. Okay. So we have minutes from August 27th, 2008. I'll deal with that later. So minutes from August 27th, 2008. Any corrections, comments?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Okay. Any dissent to approving the minutes? Seeing none. It's approved, and now we move on to minutes from October 15th, 2018. Any corrections? Okay, any second? Okay, any dissents? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. Andy, do you have a motion?
I'd like to motion to introduce the Master of Engineering student and call an election.
So there's a motion to add an election to fill in the Masters of Engineering voting membership seat. Okay. Is there any dissent?
Clarification. This is probably a longer conversation, but we try to have voting members if we only open up to people who are already here and there's never anything said on someone who might not have been here today because they're ill or someone who might want to get involved and just aren't here because they're not part of the board or field run.
So, Andy actually sent out
an email to all programs that have a master's in engineering program. And a few people replied that they're interested, and Andy has said that if they are interested to run, they should come to this meeting. So we have solicited that, yes. And we currently have one person here with us, so I would like to call you to come down and maybe introduce yourself.
Basically, just introduce yourself and why you're here.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Jane Chin. I'm a master's of engineering. So, previous experience I have in kind of this area is 10-4 years at UC Davis, where I was part of the transfer advisory board. And the most interesting thing there is I worked with three different transfers. We just had something turnaround, but that was a fun experience. And definitely I'm interested in kind of being more involved in the board to do two things. So first, I would say, is to increase kind of financial aid and these things for especially grad students. And second, other types of resources, say, in particular, maybe food banks, things like that. Those are the two areas I'm really interested in kind of getting involved with and helping out in that as always.
Thank you. I can take questions, two questions, if you have any. No question? Okay. So we have a ballot, yes. And
that everyone will get.
So Matt will be doing that.
For information?
Yes.
Is it possible to go via a different method?
Yeah, Manisha.
So I actually served on the elections committee last year, and this was a change that we made where we retired even in the case of one person to do a vote by ballot, and you're essentially voting either for that person or you're doing what's called a no confidence vote. So if you read your ballot thing, you're essentially saying, or you say, like, you write in no confidence, you're saying that you would rather do the speech vacant than put the person to ban. And this is because we found in the past that most times, even people weren't actually comfortable. In theory, they didn't want to say it in front of a group, but they wanted to trigger a no confidence vote. So that had been implemented in the election guidelines last year, which will be really updated for this year's cycle. That's the why we put out here.
Okay. But also, can I clarify first? So, also, we're going to pass out the ballot, but we're going into division breakout. So you can do that, the writing during the division breakout, and we'll collect it. So we won't be, you know, waiting around for to count the ballots. Okay. If you're concerned about time, yes.
Yeah. In relation to time, can we like make division breakout first?
Yes. Yes. Dietrich, did you have something? Okay. Cool. So.
Okay. Does everyone
know where they're
going?
Why is it
a sign? So you would go here.
Yes. Okay. I'm just going to give you a provision. Yes, that idea. Yes. So that would be.
This is your chair. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Engineering is physical science.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is your new
person. Yeah. Can you help in hearing other people? I just.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're just meeting right outside.
Okay.
Just around the or. We'll be back here in like a couple minutes.
So 5 to 7 minutes.
Yeah.
Charter changes from last year never actually got put up. So on page, like, the new seats that were filled don't actually exist in our current version of the website.
That has been like that for a while. The current version on the website is continuously outdated.
Yeah, and I've been telling you, telling Gina, and she's telling me to do it.
I mean, to be honest, like, I thought I still don't think
it's a while. I didn't agree. Don't blind yourself.
Is that really called name test? Is that the right word?
We call it black.
Yeah. I thought it was all the placards, right? But that's why I was laughing so hard at the idea of calling something a name test.
So, are all the platforms that are on the platform? So in the interest of time, we have to quickly go through the remaining two items in the agenda. There's a motion for it. Okay. Any dissent? Okay, seeing none, I promise that we won't extend more than 5 minutes. So we have next our committee update. So as usual, we have a page on committee updates in your packets. Yes. So there's a committee update page on this. Unless any committee chair who's present has something that is super, super urgent, I ask that you just send your additional updates to Alexa, and she'll get it out to everyone after the meeting. Anything super urgent?
My email is arc3pz.
Okay. So before we move to open forum, I would like to confirm that Chen Wan is our new Masters of Engineering voting member. Okay. And we have like a minute for open forum. Yes?
The GPSA is hosting the 25th anniversary ceremony at the Zagreb Barn from 4:30 to 5:30 on Friday. So make sure you come out. You can get pizza and cake and free beer. So it's really good news.
So what more do you want?
Yeah. Yes. And cake, right? Yes.
A job.
So
trying to be the manager to be careful.
So Caitlin has a little update that is also in the packet.
Right. Yeah, so in your packet on the second last page the details, and this is also linked to the agenda that went out to everybody, within the committee updates. But there's three things going on. First, the Masters of Health Administration students have started a mobile food bank, mobile B&B, and there is fruit, prepared foods, non-perishable goods that are free for any student, and we're trying to get the word out for any students who need or food insecurity issues. Currently, every Wednesday, 2:30 at the Zagreb Barn. The date and time may change in the near future.
on Wednesday, Thursday at 12:15, there's a talk about personal finances being hosted by the Gene Newman. It's open to everybody. Clark 700, 12:15. And then last, on Friday, November 9th, the Office of Engagement Initiatives is hosting a Graduate Student Institute. Anybody who's interested in community engagement, community service, current learning, if you're going to go on a learning trip this winter or spring or summer, it's a great opportunity to kind of start thinking about what community engagement is. That is November 9th, 10 a.m., also 700 Clark Hall, and there's information on how to register.
Matt, very quickly, 20 seconds.
I was going to say, regarding the food pantry side thing, I recommend you speak to people at Annabelle's Grove because they're also going to introduce it to the exact same thing.
It's not my favorite, I'm just sharing. I'm sure that they also have
it. Perfect. Kavya?
Graduate time during a lunchtime discussion tomorrow, 12:01 on women's sexual and reproductive health. So, plan time to 3:06.
And last touch.
So, around the world, we're going to bring about training to the department of women's term. So, for example, we're going to be getting a life process, which is a regular thing. So, I'll be sending out a program to see people are into it. So, I'll be tapping for the company who are in the team to get the life into it. The regular thing is the RV, so that people can be with the people in the department.
Okay. So, before my 5 minutes is up, I would entertain a motion to adjourn. Second. Any dissent?
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.